at the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Today we're going to bring you a talk, portions of a talk given by a longtime commentator and observer of the alternative scene and of the political scene, Alex Coburn. He's the editor of Counterpunch and also a contributor, a contributing editor of the a contributor to The Nation. And he was on campus last Thursday here at UC Irvine. And he has long been associated with the New Statesman before, and now he has his own publication, this Counterpunch. So we're going to bring you his talk momentarily on the situation after the U.S. conquest of Iraq. First, let's play some music that's appropriate for the times, and we'll get to that shortly.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, damaging atmosphere and blackening the sky. It's Good News Week. Someone's found a way to give the rotting dead a will to live, go on and never die. Have you heard the news? What did it say? Who's won that race? What's the weather like today? It's Good News Week. Lots of pollination now. They butchered off the sacred cow. They've got a lot to eat. It's Good News Week. Doctors finding many ways of wrapping brains and mental ways to keep us from the heat.
So it's good news for some people in the world, but not for others. Now we're going to bring you the talk by Alexander Coburn, who spoke on the situation after the conquest of Iraq by the United States. What's in store?
And we can go into that. I mean, I'll try and leave plenty of time to talk. But we are at that moment. I've had people call me up from stations across the country today saying, well, how do you feel? It's all worthwhile. So what is worthwhile? Is it worthwhile? Here we are at a time when America stands indicted in the eyes of much of the world as an international outlaw, invading a country in contravention of the principles of the UN Charter on the flimsiest of pretexts, which most of the world doesn't believe. Even if they do weapons of mass destruction now, most people think they put them there. America's general credibility is low. If the rationale was the suppression of terrorism, it doesn't take much thought to indicate that a good many terrorists have been created in the last couple of weeks for the future years for America. And we can get back for a moment into the motivations for war. But all of this, and the bloodshed, and the dislocation, the families blown to bits in cars, shot up at bridges, the service people who lost their lives, the buildings smashed, the people out in the desert in 100 degrees drinking sewage, all of this has been swept aside for a moment, and we won. And if, of course, you look back across the years, depending how old you are, there have been other moments like this, when we won. We won in Kosovo. Who goes back the day after and looks? You go back to Kosovo now, what do you see? You see basically a dump run by the mafia. If you go back, let's go back and look at Central America. the preoccupation, if we'd had this meeting in 1988, 1987, we'd have been talking about Central America. We'd have been talking about another threat. We have so many threats for the mightiest power in the history of the world. America is a very frightened country. If a mouse crawls out from under the table, we're on the top of this rostrum here, saying it's out to get us, a mouse. And you think a mouse is an exaggeration? Some of you may remember there was a time when Grenada, mighty Grenada, population 80,000, was construed by Reagan as a severe threat to the well-being of the United States. So much so that it had to be in. Why? Because it was hard to make a case that Grenada's armed forces were threatening an invasion. Even the most skilled propagandists of the Pentagon, a pretty good effort, they said that Grenada constituted a threat to our sea lanes. The presence of Grenada in the Caribbean meant that tankers proceeding to the east coast had to, as it were, float by Grenada at appalling risk to the security of this great nation. Others of you may remember that there was a threat from Nicaragua. It didn't have weapons of mass destruction. They couldn't prove that one, but they said it had an army, and in those days, Soviet trained, possibly with Cubans, two big trigger words, Soviet Cuban, and that this army might proceed north. I'm quite serious about this, you go look it up, might proceed north through Mexico, hang a right, and come up through Texas, and take Dallas-Fort Worth from the rear. Overwhelming Corpus Christi on the way through. I'm serious. I am serious. When a war scare is fomented, anything goes. Absolutely anything goes. We've been told so often that this is, after this, everything will be okay. We were told, as we look back, there was the confrontations with communism, stretching all the way through the post-war period. Why did the United States originally intervene in Iraq? Because in the 50s, as in Iran next door, there were efforts to try and introduce some social justice. What happened in Iraq is that the CIA, when Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party began to take over, they went and they said, here's a list of every possibly radical professional in the country. Everybody who might be interested in a democratic, stable future with social justice for Iraq. Here is the list. They knew what they were doing. They gave Saddam Hussein the list, and these people all got killed. The same thing happened next door in Iran when they tried to introduce Mossadegh, tried to introduce land reform in Iran. The CIA went in, gave the Shah people the same sort of lists. The Shah came to power, was ultimately overwhelmed by the Ayatollah Khomeini, whose spiritual descendants now rule in Tehran. All of this was done in the name of confronting communism, which rose to, of course, in the Vietnam Wars when 2 million people died. After the Soviet Union fell, they said, that's it, we won. Well, number one, and there's really no number two. So why, since that time, have we been so beleaguered with threats, so trembling that now we've unleashed the full power of the United States on what, by common account, at the end of 10 years of embargo, was a desperately poor country with the bulk of its infrastructure smashed up. And we said that this country, after the repeated inspections of UN inspectors, with no possible, even if they had weapons of mass destruction, no one really said that Saddam Hussein was insane enough that he would use them. Did he use them in his final days? No. And they said, we have to go in. What is it all about? Because are we now, after the days of in front of the Palestine Hotel and the cheering crowds and the overturned statue, how long before the next one? How long before we hear that the terrorists that are striking across the border into Iraq, trying to destabilize Iraq from Tehran, have to be confronted? Not long. It wouldn't take long. It wouldn't take long before you said, you heard, that some missing nuclear devices, maybe from the old Soviet Union, were in Tehran. it wouldn't take very long to say yes. Osama bin Laden and the Ayatollahs in Tehran are hand in glove. Plans have been discovered. Another go at the world, not the World Trade Center, of course, but at somewhere else in New York, or maybe Los Angeles. Another threat, another confrontation. North Korea sitting right there. North Korea has already said, don't go UN on us. We know that one. We've seen that one. Maybe they've got a nuclear weapon. Well, we've got more. We've got more than they have. Will there be a confrontation? You can go on unfurling these confrontations year after year. Are we an economy, a country, a polity permanently at war? And the answer is yes. The answer is absolutely we are at war. And the question really is why? Here we are, the wealthiest country on the planet, with a bountiful internal resources, huge internal markets. You could actually survive as an economy if you reverted and didn't have any trade at all. Why are we doing this? What is going on here? And here you come and you have to step back and take a little look at the shape and state of the world, in which the bulk of the planet has people who are living on a dime a day. And the reason they're living on a dime a day, the reason that you have huge swaths of the world being held in penury, being held as imprisoned in an endless cycle of debt by agencies of the United Nations, of the states such as the IMF, the big banks, they want their money, but it's political control too. If you want to see what was 10 years ago regarded as a huge success story for the United States, a place where free market principles were installed in every country but one, Cuba, Latin America, where the neoliberal solutions, which had been originally imposed in some of the dirtiest wars of the 20th century, starting with the Kennedys back in the early 60s, where regimes of blood and torture had overwhelmed one social reform movement after another, where the democracy of Chile had been crushed with US instigation and encouragement, where you end up now with kleptocracies across the entire continent, where you end up with public services having been destroyed, public assets pillaged, water sold off to companies, hospitals given over to private corporations usually run by cronies of the ruling powers, where two out of three people are without a job. That is the map. So then you swivel your gaze back and you say, look at Iraq, and you think those poor people, assuming they weren't given a couple of bucks to go stand in front of the Palestine Hotel, and they were relieved and joyous. There's a moment when you got rid of the guy, you got rid of Saddam Hussein, we're not being bombed. If I give the guy some flowers, maybe I'll get a job, I mightn't be shot. I'm very happy. All sorts of reasons. How long will that last? What is Iraq's real future? And that's when you really start to weep. Because what is its future? Exactly what its future was thought to be by the British in the 20s. You go back and read your history of Mesopotamia, 1917, a British force marched up between the two rivers, and they made speeches of the sort that Donald Rumsfeld has been giving, where you barely need to change a word. You might need to shorten the words a little bit, but that's about it. We come bearing hope. We come with the gift of democracy. We come as the Ottoman Empire is retreating. What happened? 3 years later, a revolt convulsed Mesopotamia, a revolt which united the Shia, the Kurds, and the Sunni, in which 8,000 of them paid with their lives before the British then bombed the country for the next 10 years. If you didn't pay your taxes, you got bombed. Because the British Air Force needed a role. Air forces always need a role. And the way you establish your role is to bomb something. Makes sense, doesn't it? When oil was discovered, Iraq has, as we all know, the second largest reserves after Saudi Arabia. And what is it going to become now? It is going to become a resource bin for the United States. a place where corporations like Bechtel can go back in to restructure the infrastructure that we destroyed. That is an absolutely perfect economic mechanism when you think about it. We destroy it and we rebuild it. We pay for the planes that they're destroying and we give the business to the Bechtel company. Donald Rumsfeld, who now stands permanently anchored to his briefing rostrum in the Pentagon, he's a guy who sure likes the limelight. In the early 80s, Rumsfeld, as some of you may know, went to Iraq. He went to talk to Saddam Hussein. Was he raising the possibility that Saddam Hussein should not use chemical weapons in the Iran war? No, it turns out he wasn't. He didn't. There have just been actually some documents released, you can find them actually on our Counterpunch website today, which were released from under FOIA, which show that Rumsfeld was there. At that time he was in private business, heading the Cell Corporation, to discuss with Saddam Hussein Bechtel's Great Green, which was to build a pipeline from the Iraqi oil fields westward, not down into the Persian Gulf, but westward into Saudi Arabia. People say, whenever you say it's about oil, people say it's more complicated than that. Please, not oil. But very often, the simple things, the obvious things, have a real truth to them. Yes, it was about oil. You can't have a country which has the second largest reserves in the world and say, there's nothing to do with oil at all. It doesn't wash. You can't get away with it. Is it the only reason? No, it's not. There are many reasons. One of them is, of course, a plan, which again many of you I'm sure have read about, which was originally hatched and to be put to Netanyahu, at that time the Prime Minister of Israel, in the middle 90s. The plan was drafted in Washington by many of the major players in the Bush administration, like Douglas Feth, Richard Perle. And what did it say? It is time to rearrange the chairs in the Middle East. It is time to eliminate a constant source of threat to Israel. It is time to finally overthrow the Saddam Hussein regime, possibly the Syrian regime, maybe confront Tehran. That plan was given to Netanyahu. There was another bit of that plan, if you're interested, by the way, which said it's time that Israel stopped getting aid from the United States. That, you never hear about that bit. That then was picked up by the Project for the New American Century, which was basically developed by a bucket shop in Washington. A lot of policy these days in Washington is developed in these think tanks, large and small. And as you know, there's a revolving door between the think tank and the administration. Private industry back to the think tank, and round you go. The Project for the New American Century took the same plan, dusted it off, got a number of prominent people, like the former head of the CIA, Woolsey, and others to sign on to it, and then put it up to Clinton and to the Republicans in opposition. This was seized upon by the Bush team, and Cheney, after the Bush team got into office, Cheney appointed all the major authors of that report. And you can find them across the administration, and they're being the leading players. Wolfowitz, Pearl, Feth, and others. You can actually literally read the documents. It's no speculation, there's no conspiracy, it's right there. Is that the major reason? No, it's another reason, to put with the first reason. This one is a lot. These people are part of the Likudniks, basically, fanatical supporters of Sharon, fanatical opponents of any kind of just settlement and dealing with the rights of Palestinians. It's the Israeli-U.S. axis at work. Of course, this is not going to be confronted by either of the two major political parties, who are terrified with any sort of confrontation with the friends of Israel in this country. So if that is an energy play, that is a power political play. There is also the idea, do they now actually wish to see any kind of reform across the Middle East? Absolutely not. U.S. power reposes on long-enduring Arab dictatorships. Anyone, and I'm sure there are many Iraqis who feel we would at last like to have our long postponed democracy. But how would the US react if, lo and behold, the Shia said we want closer relations with Tehran? Oh no, that's not a very good idea. We actually want to have fair distribution of the fruits of our assets, oil. If you want a little insight into what measure of economic policies might be obtaining in restructured Iraq, there are a couple of quite interesting little stories in the Wall Street Journal. Down in the port of Umkasa, which is being given to a major company which has been involved in trying to break the Longshoremen's Union on the West Coast, one of the first things they did was say that the wage paid by the dock laborers in Umkasa of 25 cents an hour was way too much. Way too much. Then another little story said that the truck drivers who were being given water, an American advisor said, if you understand free market principles, you might want to charge for the water. Actually, although I don't think anybody doubts that Saddam Hussein was a terrible fellow, if you read the early days of the administration of Iraq's nationalized oil wealth after they got the Iraqi Petroleum Company, most people who went to Iraq agreed that it was efficiently run and were widespread social services. Very good access to health care. One of the consequences of his criminal and stupid onslaught into Kuwait is it gave the pretext, I think encouraged and actually snookered into it somewhat by the United States, if you followed the whole April Glaspie affair, when she said the US wouldn't take it particularly amiss if he went into Kuwait. It allowed Iraq to become an example, to be pushed back deep, deep, deep into the poverty of the third world. So those who think, again, I feel the utmost sympathy, those who think that, no, a new day will dawn, I think, they have only, and those who encourage that in this country, those people, liberal people who said this invasion is a good idea because it will restore democracy. You say, where have you been? What history books have you been looking at? What planet are you living on? That you can say, after all the bloodshed and all the dead bodies spread from here across history back to 1945, that you can say with your hand on your heart that yes, at last we can have a progressive regime under US forces. Where have these people been? Where have they been? Now people, I don't know how you guys got your information during the war. I think war always does help coagulate one's mind on certain features. It concentrates it because it's a period when people are completely obsessed with the unfolding of events. I don't know how many people after 3 or 4 days could even bear to turn on the major media. Could even look at CNN and the triumphalism of CNN, the flag wagging, and the simple lack of information without wanting to vomit. Now, I differ with those people who say, like my friends in For Accuracy and Reporting and these other outfits, or a lot of what Chomsky writes is that, you know, progressive monopolization of the media has made it, has restricted information more and more. I think if you're sitting somewhere and the only thing you can watch is Fox News, yeah, you have a serious problem. Unless you love Fox News, in which case you've got no problem at all. But for people who want other things, there is a lot. I believe, and I don't know how many people in this room would agree with me, but actually if you have a computer, if you go online, we're probably better informed about this war, better informed about realities than ever before. I mean, how many people here on a show of hands actually followed it online, what was going on, or where to see it? I'd say well over 50-60% of people in this room. You could get BBC in 1 second. I think BBC was a mixed bag. Actually, it was interesting following what they were writing as opposed to what they were putting up on the sound waves. But there was some good reporting. You could actually get, for specialists who like to follow what detailed military news, you could get Russian military intelligence, pretty much on a real-time basis on iraqwar.ru, which has been shut down. Yeah, we shut down on the 8th. You could get every newspaper in the planet, Asian papers. You could get a relay Al Jazeera commentary and pictures. And I think that as encouraging, because I think it's that level of information that powered up the anti-war movement before the war. But you will not, I cannot tell you, some people remember what it was like trying to find things out 20, 30 years ago. You would hear there was a wonderful article in a British or a French paper, have to get someone to either read it to you or mail it to you or try to stuff it through a fax machine. It was very hard to get a lot of stuff. We do know more. I don't know if we're wiser, but we sure know more. And I think that has enabled people. It enables these demonstrations, I think, these networks of demonstrations, which we've seen, well, just since Seattle, you've seen waves of them. You had the fight against the WTO. You had the fight against repayment of international debt. You've had the battle to stop slave wages at the Snicker factories in Indonesia. You've had these movements, and they genuinely is a world movement now, an extremely well-informed one. And I think that's what powered up the largest demonstrations in the history of the planet. Now, were those futile? Did they achieve nothing? I don't believe so. I think they actually placed on warning. I don't think the Bush administration expected that. I don't think Turkey, I don't think the Turkish parliament would have historically voted no to allowing the Northern Front to be used as a throughput for troops unless they felt the world is with us. It was battle. And that, I believe, is we are seeing a stage in the development of a world protest movement with, I think, immense future and immense consequences. It's true it didn't stop the war. But that doesn't mean it was all for naught. And I think people who now say that the peace movement must go mainstream, it can't be unrespectable. The peace movement believes in a lot of things that aren't mainstream, will never be mainstream. The peace movement supports Mumia Abu-Jamal on the battle against the death penalty. The peace movement's attitude on the respected institutions of Western capitalism is not, will never be respectful enough. And I think that movement will develop and gather strength in 100 different ways in the years to come.
You're listening to a talk given by Alexander Coburn at UC Irvine last Thursday. This is Dan Tsang on Subversity here on KUCI. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Now let's return to this lecture given by Alex Coburn on the peace movement and on the situation after the U.S. conquest of Iraq.
And it goes, one of the things goes back to the fact that when people say, you know, it's all Fox News, it's not true. You can go across this country, I don't care what state you're in, and you'll find groups in cities across this country, normally dismissed by coming out of the solid blue middle. They've never been there. They haven't the biggest idea what they're talking about. You can go to any state in the Union and find cities and groups in absolute protest against the war. You should look at some other things. For the first time in its history, since before the First World War, in almost 100 years, the AFL-CIO said no to the war before it began. That is an absolutely historic moment. But what does it show? It shows that, and Labour has organizationally is in a much weaker position than it was 50 years ago. They finally realized that the old constituencies they were playing to when George Meany and the others came up for the war in Vietnam and went up and beat up demonstrators in downtown New York. Those days are gone. The future of labor, if it's anywhere, is with people who aren't in sympathy with those kind of wars. There are shop stewards and organizers who came out of Central America, who were in El Salvador, as labor organizers who are now up here. It's a whole new ball game in labor. What are we going to see in the months to come? We are at the acme of interest right now, Iraq. Everyone knows where it is. The maps are there. The armchair generals will soon hang up their helmets and go home. Slowly it will disappear from the news. What will be happening on the ground? Politics will return to Iran. The old Iraqi Communist Party still has a lot of strength. The Shia groups have a vast presence. The Kurds are there. Politics will develop. They're already, as the murder of Majid, who I mentioned at the start, showed, there already is the idea that they would cross that border from Kuwait and it would be flowers all the way to Baghdad. That's gone. It's gone. There are people who welcome. Of course they do. As I said, Saddam is a brutal tyrant. But when the reality sets in that this is a poor country with half the population under the age of 16, do you want to ask questions or do you want to do a running commentary?
Mm-hmm. I mean, at least it should be balanced, I believe.
We can make a running commentary. Have some manners.
You can go do a lecture.
Make freedom of speech.
Yeah, it's not the freedom to be rude. If you have a country of that sort where expectations cannot be answered to the degree that they're raised, you are going to soon have violence, you're going to have internecine struggle, and you're going to have probably a struggle against the force that's there, the United States. A parallel which I would direct your attention to is probably Beirut in 1982. More or less the same thing happened at greater speed. The Israeli forces cut north. They came to Beirut. They were welcomed, genuinely welcomed, flowers and cheers by the Shia population. 6 months later, the whole picture had changed. All the dreams that Israel had of restructuring that area disappeared. First of all, with a truck bomb that killed about 80 or 90 Israelis. Then, so far as the United States was concerned, a truck bomb that killed 235 Marines. And it wasn't long before Israel had withdrawn back down to the border and beyond. 6 months is a very long time in politics. So I think we should look now and say, okay, it is in a way a happy moment for a lot of Iraqis, but there's a much longer term reality. The longer term reality is, why are these wars launched? And let's look at one more thing. What is the cost of these wars at home? With this war and the war on terror have come at a huge cost. Beginning, of course, with the cost of people who lost their lives in September 11, but what are other enormous costs? The steady erosion of constitutional liberties. With the war abroad has come a war at home. The drug war, which began in 1982, have already severely eroded the Bill of Rights, constitutional protections, the Fourth and the Sixth Amendments. Now what you've seen with Ashcroft's Justice Department is, and they've been thwarted in some ways because some of the plans are so insane that they didn't even bother with them for a while. The idea that Admiral Poindexter should read everybody's credit card. This was a guy who, when he was trying to wipe out evidence of his criminal complicity in the Iran-Contra scandal, and he was wiping all his emails off his laptop in the White House, he forgot that it was all stored on the hard drive downstairs. But we will see continuing attacks, if you look at the terms of the Second Patriot Act, to further onslaughts and attacks. I think we are, in those terms, at a pretty perilous moment. Very perilous moment. In which the conditions and premises that does make this a great democracy, in many ways, could begin be eroded very, very seriously. In terms of the right for a defense, you have American citizen held as an enemy combatant without right of access to a lawyer. You could find things like the Freedom of Information Act disappear. You could find all of these things fairly rapidly going out the window. I'm not convinced that they will. I think people have an enormous strength of resistance if push comes to shove. If there's any sort of adequate political responsibility displayed by the opposition, who at the moment, the Democrats, completely cowed, most of them. If you look at them. Maybe about, you could count on about 20 to 30 Democrats in the House of Representatives to really stand up where it counts. People like Kucinich. So that is another major factor. But if we want to step back one more stage, and I'll close with this point, then we can have some discussion. Since September 11th and the war on terrorism, have really the context and the fuel for terrorism been diminished or increased? I think everyone would answer increased, most likely. Now, when you fight a war, has it been a sensible war? Now, you have to fight wars sometimes. Has this been a prudent, a well-managed war, or just a rash, foolish war? Has the war addressed causes of terrorist violence? I don't believe it has. Let's start with a cause everybody acknowledges, the situation of Palestinians. Worse, far worse. Vociferous support by the administration for Sharon as Israeli bulldozers bulldoze down Palestinian houses, gradually nibble away at Palestinian enclaves, build roads, gradually turn what was going to be a Palestinian state into a series of tiny little blocks surrounded by fortified settlements, enormous roads, and an occupying army. And I should add, I think some of the most courageous people in the world today are the international solidarity movement, people from this country confronting that, ready to risk their lives just as Rachel Corrie actually paid her. So, has the running sore, so to speak, of the Palestinian situation been addressed? No. Has another running sore mentioned, the US occupation troops in Saudi Arabia addressed? No. But more profoundly, have the major inequities in the world, the fact that country after country is a sinkhole of poverty and frustration, has that been addressed? There could have been a program. You could have said, okay, we're going to go after terrorists, we're going to be rough, but we also are going to launch a Marshall Program to try and reverse the balance, the deepening spiral of poverty that afflicts so much of the world. That, for that alone, economic development and a measure of social justice, that's what, in the end, reduces terror. You don't reduce terror with the jackboot. You really don't, not in the long term. And so, do we look forward to more wars, more possibilities of terror, more repression of terror? There's this distinct possibility, but I believe that resistance is great. The spirit of hope burns in the human bosom. I'm sure many people here are eager to resist, and so I'll leave us with that thought.
Been our custom in this series. I would like to remind you that we have two microphones here for people to ask questions. I'd like, I guess we normally have one for the students, one for the others, and I think we'll just have to say wherever you're closest, line up please. It's very difficult to figure out who's first, so if you have questions, comments, please start forming the mic and we'll take every other question that way. I also would like to remind you what our Chancellor has urged us to keep in mind is the civility of our discussion. And we've never had any problems in the past. I expect now, too, that we will be respectful. These are life and death matters, and everyone's emotions are high, so I urge you all to keep in mind our respect for each other's opinions.
Thank you very much for that talk, Mr. Coburn. I'd like to link two ideas that you brought up, namely repression of dissent here at home in the form of the Patriot Act, and the one thing everyone agrees on from across the political spectrum, the increased chance of terrorism, in the words of Dick Cheney and his friends, it's not a question of if, but when. Now, when the next terrorist attack occurs in the United States, it is my impression that the argument will be put forward that the Patriot Act 1 and 2 did not go far enough, and that we need to actually increase restraints on dissent we will need to imprison. We will need to basically impose martial law here. Do you think I'm being paranoid?
Maybe. I hope you are. I hope you are. Look, emergency legislation is used in the same way. I mean, imagine some atrocious assault, a huge disaster in a city. You could imagine that happening in a nanosecond. It's the nature of emergencies that it's when it suddenly happens, and then you get acts on the books, like the British emergency laws in England, were all put on the books in the early part of the century. You never get them off. I mean, I think people here will be spending years, decades, trying to push back some of the terms of the Patriot Act and some of the, along with, the increasingly repressive policies and laws put forward by the Justice Department. It's a long, long haul. So yes, I think that could happen. But, it's a hypothesis because you have to say, well, we're an attack and what nature would it be?
Very quick comment. I agree with just about everything you said in your talk, except that we know more now than ever before. I agree that we have access to more information. But I think that not only Fox News, but NBC, ABC, et cetera, pretty much sets the terms of discourse for the large segment of the population. And I was wondering if you could also say something about the unprecedented information war that was the war inside the war here in Iraq. The Al Jazeera website you mentioned, for example, was shut down. The English version was shut down within 24 hours. The Palestine Hotel was attacked by a tank day before yesterday. You're well aware of that, where the reporters were seen. Mm-hmm. I believe also interference with this Russian website for quite some time, but it got back on. This information, would you say something about it, if you're so inclined?
Sure. Of course, as you rightly said, the thing I should really look at Al Jazeera is the fact that the Al Jazeera correspondent was killed in a rocket attack about 5 hours before the Palestine Hotel was shelled from a U.S. tank. And that's, to me, of the two episodes. I follow this pretty closely because my brother is with the Independent. He was in northern Iraq and was about 5 minutes behind a convoy containing the BBC's John Simpson that was attacked and strafed by a U.S. plane that killed Simpson's assistant. So keeping a close family interest on attacks on journalists. The Al Jazeera guy had gone to the U.S. and said, our offices are here, because the Al Jazeera offices in Kabul were destroyed. And they said, there's our office, number 123, whatever street it was, by the Tigris River, and that was shelled and the guy was killed. Then a few hours later, the Palestine Hotel was attacked. The general, what was his name, Buford, I think, said, we came under fire. People who've listened to the Agence France-Presse tape say it was completely silent for the preceding 4 minutes. It's conceivable that the guy in the tank saw a glint off a camera lens and thought they were being attacked and fired off a shell, which killed, I think, 3 people. There's, to my mind, no question that Al Jazeera was very discomforting to the U.S. administration. First of all, because it had, some very courageous reporters who were taking, pictures of what was coming into the hospitals, particularly after Al-Hilla and the cluster bomb killed all those women and kids. And secondly, because it's just putting a different point of view. It's a challenge. Back in the 70s, there was a lot of fighting in the UN for something called the New World Information Order, which was an effort by third world countries to say that our news was being totally dictated by first world corporations. Now, of course, here is Al Jazeera, which is, by common acknowledgement, it oddly enough just got a prize from Index on Censorship for its courage and cunning in evading saying things that in the Arab world had been unsayable. People always go on about the tyrannies in the Arab world, which is true. Here is a relatively free station, which is, of course, has become a keen object of dislike by the U.S. administration. So I think there was the non-embedded press. There were some Portuguese journalists that were pretty roughly treated. I have to say, as far as the embedded press is concerned, I think it didn't quite came out the way the Pentagon anticipated it would. I think there were a lot of reporters there that actually did really good jobs, and you could read in UPI and even Business Week. I read some terrific reporting. I mean, they just wrote down what they saw in front of their faces. The best single report I read was by a guy called Franchetti in the London Times, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch. Franchetti's report of March 30, which described a US unit that began, you know, expecting roses and ended up so jumpy and terrified that they shot up a van load of women and children, is an absolute classic of war reporting. Anyway, sorry, you've been standing there for a long time.
That's okay. I have two related questions. A friend of mine has developed a theory that because of the war and the movement against it internationally, that a second force was developed as a power in the world, as the first force being the United States. And it's his theory that the people's movement will now be a force possibly equal to the United States. So I'd be interested in your comment on that. The second part is, I live in Birmingham, Alabama, where we have a small but active and vocal peace group.
I know, my friends in the Lawyers Guild are now, I know those people.
Well, you know me, that's me.
Well, you know, it's you, my God. You know,
anyway,
sadly, you don't expect him and you don't recognize him.
Oh, that's only a year and a half, that's okay. Your other friend is with Andrew, and they're meeting tonight wondering what direction they should take now. They want to disband, they want to keep fighting. Where should they go now? Thanks.
Ah, well, the people's movement in the world. Like the Nation magazine had a cover, the other world power or something like that, there was a picture of that. It's the same idea. I mean, there's another word, power is power. And it's the power of power, I mean, the control of resources, the allocation of funds, the control of armed forces is enormously powerful, and the power of people is something that ebbs and flows. It can overwhelm governments, you know, at certain points. It can be a huge moral reproach to governments, and it can provoke political action. In my view, one of the things that could happen next is, you know, there've been these and a lot of summits in Latin America about an alternative economic future for the world. And countries like Malaysia and maybe Brazil, that would be the big one, are saying we will never repay our debt. We can't do it. If we try to pay down our debt, even on a slowed up schedule, we, you know, we just face ruin for years to come. And it could be that structure of political control represented by the IMF will be eroded in the same way that after the Asian crash, some of the Asian countries said, we're not on board this one anymore. We're not going to do it. So I think it's a little too, pie in the sky to say, you know, we have a world movement and it's going to change everything. But in the end, world movements of ideas, world movements of alternatives produce the politicians, produce the politics, produce the moral force to judge change things. Now, the other one was?
What next?
Oh, what next? Well, some of the peace movement is reactive. I think there will be probably maybe a slowing up of energies, that maybe the energy will return back into the domestic legislation. But how long before we have another external crisis? And you know, where will that external crisis be? Right now they're shoveling money down to Colombia, you know, for a push against the guerrillas there, another stroke in the drug war. I mean, if we're on a continuously moving frontier, I think opportunity will present itself to us.
I'm concerned about the impact of rule of law in the international sense. You stated earlier that the United States invasion was against the principles of the United Nations. In fact, it was against binding international legal norms, and that the act of ordering the invasion constituted the international crime of aggression under international law. So it wasn't just principles that we violated. Does law matter here? Does international law matter? Should it matter? If so, why? If not, why not? I'm concerned about the impact upon international law and all we've done in the last 50 years since the Second World War to build up an international legal system, and then having this act, which to me militates against rule of law.
Right. Everyone heard the question. Right? I think, I mean, if you look at, you can look at the development of UN in two ways since the Second World War. You can see the gradual development of, or the enunciation of noble principles, under the UN Charter. No wars except in self-defense, the mechanisms of the Security Council, and you could say this is the evolution of a visionary idea of a global system. Or you can say, oh, well, really, the UN, as a practical matter for most of its existence, has been a rubber stamp to the United States. As a practical matter, when you look through it, when the British and the French, in a last attempt to assert their own independence back in the 50s, invaded the Suez Canal, the UN actually went to the General, they couldn't get the vote in the Security Council, they went to the General Assembly, and they got a majority to condemn the British and French actions. And all the Secretaries General, in one way or another, have really been there with the approval of the United States. And Kofi Annan, you know, is really behaves as though he's a wholly owned subsidiary, and he hasn't got much alternative, to be frank with you, in today's world. In the world when you had the Soviet Union conceived of as the other major power, you could have someone like Dag Hammarskjöld who could, you know, steer a slightly more complicated course. Does that mean that we really say, and some people say, you know, really, what is the point of, you know, invoking the UN? In the case of Kosovo and Yugoslavia, they didn't even go to the UN. It was a NATO business. Well, I think it's a bit like occasionally people say, you know, the US Constitution is really, you know, written by a bunch of white property holders in the 18th century and it hasn't got any relevance to the modern world. Foolish thing to say. Because, first of all, if you don't have that, what have you got? In the same way, if you don't have the UN, what have you got? Are you going to now revert to just... You say, okay, now we've torn aside the fig leaf and now we have the ugly reality. Or can you say, well, fig leaves are a pretty good idea. What's your philosophical attitude to fig leaves is, but... And we can build them into our whole costume if we want to. I think we've taken that analogy as far as I can push it. So, I think it was important that although you can look at the UN, you shouldn't look at the UN starry-eyed. And people who say, you know, the UN, our body, you know, the UN is countenanced and ignored countless crimes. I mean, I can only remind you of the embargo against Nicaragua. I mean, I could, again, could have stood in this room at that time and said, you know, what's the UN doing? Where's what the US has totally flooded the world court in The Hague. You know, time after time, the veto power has been used with only two or three nations supporting the US, and so on. But yes, there is a structure of international law, the same way that there are conventions governing the treatment of prisoners. And it was amazing, just to go on to a point, where suddenly in the war, Donald Rumsfeld, of all people, suddenly began to invoke the Geneva Convention about treatment of prisoners. This was after, I think, some US prisoners had been displayed on TV. And he said, you know, it's against the Geneva Conventions to display prisoners in any circumstances that degrades from their dignity. It didn't take a very powerful memory to remember masked people lying on the ground in Guantanamo, being photographed. The lives of prisoners should be respected. There's some fairly compelling accounts that after the victory of the Northern Front in Afghanistan, if you look at a film by Jamie Dornan, which has not been shown in this country, the US may have been at best standing by, and at worst, in the murder of about 7,000 prisoners. 7,000 who were shot in trucks, trucks with machine gun. They were left in the trucks for 3 or 4 days, finally turned out in the desert for most of them shot. 7,000 people, that's a major war crime.
Alex Coburn, who was lecturing here on campus at University of California, Irvine, last week, talking about the aftermath of the conquest of Iraq and also what looks ahead for the peace movement. You're listening to Subversity here on KUCI 89 FM. The opinions expressed on this show were not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. For more information about this show and about other shows, you can go to the Subversity website at kuci.org/tilde DTSANG. DTSANG. Coming up, we're going to play you a little song to close the program. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all flowers gone. Young girls defend everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Where have all the young girls gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young girls gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young girls gone? Gone to young men everywhere.